He is a professor of history at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and he is the author of Quest for Empire and, more recently, Mormonism and the American Experience. His talk will be commented on by Marty Jones, who is an attorney in Provo. And I'll now turn the time to you, Klaus Hansen.
I'm afraid that I'm going to read a rather formal paper. I wrote this out, and perhaps for an occasion like this, a more informal presentation would have been appropriate, but if you bear with me, I will try to pretend not to read if I can do that. In the demonology of feminist rhetoric, the term patriarchy holds a position analogous to that of the devil in Christian theology. It is therefore not surprising that those societies regarded as patriarchal have not generally enjoyed favorable treatment in contemporary feminist scholarship. Negative feminist assessment of the antebellum South and Mormonism, for example, derive much of their critical animus from the patriarchal underpinnings of those cultures. According to Catherine Clinton, author of a recent work on the plantation mistress, chattel slavery and the enslavement of free women, whether white or black, had much in common. It should not be surprising that from this perspective, that other twin of the relics of barbarism, Mormon polygamy, was likewise regarded as a form of slavery. Though both relics have been abolished, a patriarchal hangover has resulted in a feminist cultural lag among both Southern and Mormon women. Although in its abbreviated form, such an interpretation is not without plausibility, a number of studies by revisionist feminist scholars or scholars sympathetic to feminist interpretations presents a picture of the patriarchal cultures of the Old South and of pre-manifesto Mormonism as more complex and paradoxical than seen in the more traditional literature. Much of that literature had an underlying progressive liberal bias, often linked to modernization theory. The story of emancipation, whether from slavery or polygamy, was the triumph of a liberal modern spirit over reactionary forces of patriarchal authority. Progress, to be sure, was not always linear, could not be represented by a steadily upward moving line on a graph. The forces of reaction did not give up easily, as racism and sexism continued to reappear in unexpected places. Still, a step backward was overcome by two steps forward, and so on. From the 1960s on, however, this progressive interpretation was seriously questioned by a new generation of scholars who emphasized the persistence of racism and sexism, stressing the enormous damage inflicted on women and racial minorities by a dominant, largely white, male culture. This interpretation, however, was soon seen as problematic by a number of historians of slavery and the role of women in American society because it tended to reduce these groups to a status of helpless victimhood. The demonization of the slavocracy and the patriarchy, ironically, also reflected badly on its victims and thus stood in the way of historical understanding. What was called for was a retreat from an approach centered on the moral dimensions of an unequal power relationship. Without denying these, in fact, taking this kind of immoral power, exercise of power for granted, a new generation of scholars was more interested in precisely how elites exercised power and how those in a subordinate position negotiated these relationships. Subordinates, far from being mere victims, emerged as historical agents capable of driving agendas of their own, even while having to acknowledge and accept the exercise of power by a dominant class of planters or patriarchs. Eugene Genovese has argued persuasively that paternalism, resting on reciprocal relations between masters and slaves, though largely defined by the former, provided slaves with sufficient space to develop a life and a culture not defined by victimhood alone, but by their own humanity. The case of white Southern women is more complex, since some of the leading feminists were at the same time members of the planter class. Southern historian C. Van Woodward, in a discussion of the famous diarist Mary Chesnut, expressed puzzlement at, quote, how such vehement feminism burst out of a thoroughly patriarchal order, unquote. What may seem even more puzzling on the face of it is the tolerance of the planters. If Mary Chesnut's feminism may have been particularly vehement, there were numerous other Southern women whose articulation of women's rights made Chesnut less than extraordinary. The Southern Belle, it appears, was more a figment of the imagination of Hollywood movie makers than of antebellum reality, with plantation mistresses being kept busy running large households. Of course, within the hegemonic world of the planters, the identity of the women was defined primarily by class, not gender, so that any expressions of female independence may not have been perceived as a threat as long as the boundaries of class and race were maintained. Thus, if Eugene Genovese is correct, and also Elizabeth Fox Genovese particularly wrote on this, the boundaries of class versus race, the paradox of planter class hegemony was that it allowed a certain degree of autonomy to subordinate groups precisely because the planters were secure in their position of domination. It was only after the collapse of that class that mechanisms of control changed, which explains the virulent racism and sexism that erupted in the South in the wake of the Civil War. Realizing the pitfalls of analogies and comparisons, I do not wish to argue for a one-to-one relationship between 19th century Mormonism and the antebellum South, whether interpreted by Genovese or anyone else. After all, the economic and cultural basis of the Mormon kingdom had little in common with that of the slave South. Yet, because in both societies, social control was exercised by patriarchal authority, if for very different reasons, it may be appropriate to draw some loose parallels as a kind of heuristic device to help illuminate the paradoxical history of female Mormon culture under changing theories and practices of patriarchy. Given the space and time constraints of a conference such as this, my remarks should be seen as the presentation of a tentative hypothesis that requires further testing through careful analysis of appropriate historical examples. In recent years, a number of scholars have significantly enlarged and deepened our understanding of the role of women in a patriarchal Mormon society. What is surprising about these accounts is that, analogous to the history of women in the antebellum South, Mormon women in the 19th century appear to have been more involved in shaping and running their society and church than they were after the demise of patriarchy. Rejecting the progressive assumptions of a previous generation, the pioneering work of these modern scholars suggests that, in many respects, Mormon women in the 19th century enjoyed a degree of authority, autonomy, and independence that may be the envy of their modern sisters. In Emma Smith, Mormonism's first lady, historians have found a key witness testifying to the importance and influence of women in the early church. Linda Newell's and Val Avery's biography of Emma makes it very clear that she played a central and creative role in the founding of Mormonism that encompasses far more than the roles of helpmate and amanuensis. A revelation in the Doctrine and Covenants singled out Emma with a special gift to expound scriptures and to exhort the church, a function she continued to perform after her assumption of the leadership of the Female Relief Society of Nauvoo in 1842. In her study of the minutes of the society, Linda Newell has determined that Joseph Smith intended the organization, quote, as an essential part of the church, unquote, introducing the membership to the, quote, ceremony of the temple endowments, including washings and anointings. There is considerable evidence to suggest that Joseph Smith envisioned the Relief Society as an independent organization for women parallel to the priesthood organization for men. Yet both seem to come under the aegis of the priesthood as a power from God, not as an administrative entity. Clearly, regarding the organization as more than a charitable society, the sisters exercise spiritual gifts, such as healing and speaking in tongues, under the leadership of Emma. In the opinion of Sousa Young Gates, famous daughter of Brigham Young, the privileges and powers outlined by the prophet in those first meetings have never been granted to women in full even yet. Gates wrote this comment in 1905, at a time when the church leadership had begun to curtail the full exercise of these gifts by women. In an obvious attempt to rationalize this change, she asked rhetorically, did those women, do you and I, live so well as to be worthy of them all? The kind of stock question demanding a negative reply, given that we're all sinners. Linda Newell must be commended for her feisty answer, that when the lives of Latter-day Saints women, their faith, spirituality, devotion, and sacrifice are seen across the history of the church, we find the record as venerable as that of men. We must respond to Sousa's question in the affirmative. Emma's story, however, should not be seen as an unqualified endorsement for the power of women in the early days of Mormonism. Indeed, the idea of patriarchy as paradox imposes explicit limits on Emma's role in the establishment of female power in the church. Emma learned this only too soon when she vigorously opposed Joseph's introduction of plural marriage, claiming that the principle was not of God and was pressured into resigning as president of the Relief Society. To the extent that the prestige of Emma was a key element in giving power to women in the church, her decline in power could not help but have negative effect on all Mormon women. Sorry, okay. Can you hear me better now? I have to stay a little further away from this microphone. So that Emma learned this only too soon when she vigorously opposed Joseph's introduction of plural marriage, claiming that the principle was not of God, and was pressured into resigning as president of the Relief Society. To the extent that the prestige of Emma was a key element in giving power to women in the church, her decline in power could not help but have a negative effect on all Mormon women, especially after the death of Joseph. It is interesting to speculate on Emma's influence had Brigham Young succeeded in persuading her to move to Utah. My suspicion is that he was secretly relieved that she didn't take him up on his offer. As it was, the Relief Society remained in limbo for some years, and its reorganization was not accompanied by the promise of spiritual gifts so lavishly showered on Emma. Not that women under Brigham didn't enjoy a significant degree of influence and autonomy. It is just that in keeping with the principle of patriarchal hegemony, such powers had to be exercised under the aegis of Brigham's authority, to which Emma would have presented a clear threat. For just as slavery was essential to planter hegemony, so was polygamy to the hegemony of patriarchs in the early Mormon kingdom. Although this did not mean that the majority of women had to practice polygamy any more than it meant that the majority of Southerners had to be slaveholders, it did mean that the majority had to accept the respective worldviews of those in authority. This was especially true of a coterie of leading sisters who exercised power seemingly independently of the principle of polygamy. Maureen Beecher has described in fascinating detail the evolution of a female hierarchy in 19th century Mormon society who were free to create their own forms of personal, social, and political relationships. This informal but powerful group had its origins in Nauvoo, was centrally involved in organizing the Relief Society. Many of them were linked by kinship and marriage to the highest echelons in the hierarchy, and their shared group experience in Nauvoo during the Exodus and the early years in Salt Lake did much to connect them in a network that ruled informally the whole society of Mormon women, performing for the female saints functions parallel to those carried out by the general authorities. In the 1860s, Brigham Young envisioned a widening of women's roles to include the functions exercised by men in the school of the prophets, an economic planning council formed to promote the economic independence of the Mormon kingdom. While this idea was never formalized, the women, in fact, became actively involved in the cooperative movement as well as in the United Order, projects launched under the auspices of the school. The women also assumed leading roles in the General Sunday School Union, the Retrenchment Associations, later called MIA, and the Primary Associations. Rather than taking their cue from male priesthood leaders, the women promoted unilateral action, as a quotation from Maureen Beecher, assuming roles of, quote, unhindered leadership, unquote. By the turn of the century, as formal structures replaced informal ones, ironically a process to which these women contributed, the network of leading sisters declined, with most of its functions delegated to women now acting under the official direction and supervision of male priesthood leaders. And rather read this delegated, I think perhaps relegated would be actually a better word. It is no accident that this change occurred after the manifesto, as patriarchal hegemony in the Mormon kingdom had declined. Until recently, feminist scholarship, for the most part, has regarded polygamy in an extremely negative light, a kind of neo-abolitionist literature not unlike anti-slavery literature, reminiscent of Harriet Beecher Stowe's famous indictment that polygamy was, quote, slavery which debases and degrades womanhood, motherhood, and family. However, modern feminists have begun to view polygamy more favorably. Some 20 years ago, I happened to be on a train with Gerda Lerner, who has since become one of the most notable of American feminist historians. As we discussed our respective historical interests, she remarked that in her opinion, Mormon polygamy was an extremely complex institution that deserved further serious study, and that, from a feminist perspective, did not compare unfavorably with a modern nuclear family. Embedded as it was in a cooperative ethos, polygamy fostered a degree of sisterhood that might well have been the envy of women living in monogamy. Sisterhood, of course, became a widespread middle-class phenomenon of homosocial relationships between women who found themselves isolated at home as their husbands and fathers battled for economic success in the marketplace. Such relationships, primarily social and psychological, were a kind of class-based luxury that excluded millions of lower middle-class and working-class women for whom patriarchy was a social and economic burden, entailing the kind of oppression beyond the experience of most middle-class women. As for Mormon women, precious few would have fit into that female world of love and ritual so brilliantly described by Carol Smith Rosenberg. Rather, most of them were forced to be socially and economically self-reliant, partly because frontier conditions demanded it, partly because the economics of plural marriage called for a contribution from the woman beyond that of women in conventional middle-class marriages. The positive side of this equation is that women in polygamous marriages bonded in a sisterhood that had both psychological and economic dimensions, thus affording them a degree of independence greater than that of many of the middle-class monogamous sisters. With the gradual cessation of polygamy after the manifesto, the roles of Mormon women changed. conforming increasingly to American middle-class norms. Patriarchal hegemony was replaced by the direct supervision of the priesthood over a much constricted sphere of influence. Women's participation in both informal and formal church functions was curtailed both by unofficial and official church policy, beginning around the turn of the century, and formalized by the priesthood correlation program introduced by Joseph F. Smith in 1906. Gaining momentum in the period between the two world wars and reaching a climax in the intensified priesthood correlation program from the 1960s on. The reasons for this transformation are varied and complex. It has been suggested that early Mormon society was unstructured, informal, and in constant flux. Centers of power developed in a pragmatic, ad hoc fashion, allowing for some experimentation, and hence greater access by women to those centers. However, I'm suggesting that quite possibly the reverse was true, that Joseph and his associates, for all their experimentation, firmly established male hegemony early on. Yet, secure in their privileged male position, allowed women significant room for action. In the 19th century, the central idea around which Mormonism revolved was the kingdom of God, with plural marriage as the most significant social expression of that kingdom. It was a society pitted against a hostile world, a counter-reality, as Gordon Pollack described it, or, in the words of John Shipps, a society living in sacred space and time. In Marvin Hill's interpretation, the kingdom was anti-pluralistic, an alternative to the dominant liberal society of antebellum America. In that sense, it was not unlike the paternalistic society of the Old South, which likewise stood in opposition to the liberal consensus. Both societies saw themselves as besieged by outside forces, necessitating an articulate defense and leading to intellectual conformity and the suppression of dissent. At the same time, the paternalistic elites ruling these societies saw themselves as having delineated clear social boundaries and having established a legitimacy to rule that was virtually unquestioned internally. Secure in their patriarchal sense of self, these elites could demonstrate the legitimacy of their authority by allowing a modicum of freedom to subordinate groups, as long as these did not challenge the foundations of power, be they political, social, or ecclesiastical. However, with the demise of the old order, all that changed, as Mormons were catapulted out of sacred space and time and were in danger of becoming just one more religious denomination in a pluralistic secular America. New boundaries had to be established and maintained. In the New South, race and a new cult of womanhood had to assume a burden of separation that had been carried more effectively by slavery before its demise. Among Mormons, the word of wisdom assumed a symbolic position it had lacked in the past, while an intensified drive for sexual purity and the monogamous family coincided with an increasing affirmation of male priesthood authority that could not tolerate any potential infringement on the part of women, whose contributions to society at large through spiritual gifts and the kingdom of God in its various manifestations were relegated to an ecclesiastical female ghetto, surrounded by a kind of cordon sanitaire that would ensure that male priesthood functions would not be compromised by women. The merging of Mormon culture with the larger American culture reached its apex in the immediate post-World War II period, at the very time that women who had been enlisted in the war effort both at home and abroad were homeward bound, to use the title of Elaine Tyler May's Perceptive Study of Retreat from Feminism. Thus, at a time when Mormon cultural values merged more fully with a larger society, the need to delineate internal gender boundaries became all the more imperative to the religious identity of Mormon males as the kingdom of God became synonymous with the church. There are those who see a turning back of the clock as a solution to the disfranchisement of Mormon women. The fundamentalists, in their call to a return of the Mormon kingdom in all its manifestations, especially polygamy, have in fact succeeded in attracting some modern women who call themselves feminists. Not long ago, the New York Times cited the case of a polygamous community, I believe it was the community of Big Water, where they were referring specifically to the plural wives of Alex Joseph, who was the mayor of the town. Many of these were educated women, and one of them was interviewed, a graduate of law, of a law school, a practicing attorney, who felt that she could be a more successful feminist in such a culture than in the competitive, individualistic, capitalist society outside. The mothers averred that they had the freedom of pursuing their professions, also being respected members of their church and their community, and secure in the knowledge that their children had the kind of love and affection from the polygamous sisters that could not be found in any secular daycare. However, to most mainstream Mormon women, this story brings up sharply the limitations of the patriarchy's paradox interpretation, serving as it does more effectively as a critique of liberal progressive ideology than as a model for future action. It may be argued that I was too uncritical of polygamous patriarchs, just as Eugene Genovese has been accused of giving too much slack to his southern planters. Certainly, I'm not calling for a return to polygamy any more than Eugene Genovese's pining for the good old days of slavery. Still, as critics of the Genovese school charge that its reaction against the damaged school, it has underestimated the severe costs exacted by slavery. So the application of patriarchy as paradox to Mormon history may discount too much the downside of polygamy. An alternative approach, emphasizing resistance, has had only limited appeal among historians not engaged in social action. Herbert Aptheker has found few converts to his argument that slave revolts were endemic in the antebellum South. Resistance as an explanatory model for Mormon feminism is even less convincing. Ultimately, the selective use of history in support of agendas for social change appeals only to the converted. A graduate student of mine, Clyde Forsberg, argues in a nearly completed dissertation that much of current feminist Mormon scholarship is propelled by such a selective use of history, exaggerating the hospitality of early Mormonism to women's concerns. In his opinion, the historical evidence that the Mormon patriarchy was oppressive to women is indeed irrefutable. If he is right, change cannot be accomplished by appealing to the past. But because of its radical implications, a retreat from history is not a position that will appeal to the majority of Mormon women who wish to remain in the church, and who will no doubt persist in their quest for a usable past. For them, the challenge is how to walk that incredibly fine line between past and future, a feat that much of current Mormon feminist scholarship is indeed attempting. Of course, even at its best, history is an imperfect guide to the future, and only time will tell whether another paradox will replace that of patriarchy. Thank you.
I come to the issues that Klaus has presented here from a somewhat different perspective. I'm not a historian, but I do consider myself a social scientist and a feminist. As a child growing up, my mother used to, on occasion, speak longingly of the institution of polygamy, primarily because of the space and support that sister wives were able to give each other those times that the institution worked, much the position of the district attorney that Claus mentioned. As the mother of anywhere between 4 and 14 children in my conscious memory, a PhD candidate and later a law student, she saw part-time wifehood and institutionalized child care support to be freeing of women in some very major ways. I read A Gift Given, A Gift Taken when it first came out, probably while I was home during vacation from the university. And more recently, the women in discussion groups I have belonged to, and many of those with whom I have associated in the university, accepted as a fundamental statement of fact that 19th century Mormon women had more freedom, autonomy, and institutional power than we do as women in today's church. So I have no questions regarding Claus's argument in this regard. In fact, in many ways, my involvement with this issue begins where Claus has ended. Given an a priori assumption that women had greater freedom and autonomy in the 19th century church, what implications does that have, and what is the relevance of that reality to ours today? Over the years, I have answered that question in many different ways. I have come to see this paradox, as Claus has referred to it, as emblematic of the complexities of social structure and power. In an early attempt to analyze and understand the reasons for the transformation of the role of women in the church, I focused on an aspect of the social structure that Claus has not mentioned here. I thought then, and still believe, that much of the space and autonomy allowed to women under polygamy stemmed from sheer necessity. It seems to me that, for all the reality of a highly formal patriarchal structure, the households of many 19th century women are remarkable more for the absence of men than for their presence. Given the limited time available to spend with different wives, and also given the fact, in many cases, of extended missionary service away from home, husbands and fathers were not the constant patriarchal presence we might expect to find in a society characterized as a patriarchal hegemony. Many, if not most, 19th century women in the Great Basin Kingdom had of necessity to develop the autonomy and strength to support themselves and their children economically and emotionally. In many cases, their primary allies in facing these challenges were their sister wives and or Relief Society sisters. From within this framework, it was easy for me to see that the autonomy of women in the church in the kingdom had to be curtailed as polygamy was gradually abandoned and the missionary program for young single men became more institutionalized. Women didn't need to give blessings once the men were more readily available, and the preference of women to turn to their sisters became less an unnoticed, pragmatic reality and more a direct challenge to the patriarchal order. I still think that this transition from absent father to Victorian ideal family played a role in the gradual curtailment of the autonomy and power of women in the church. But this is by no means the only causal factor determining the transition. As any social scientist will tell us, social transformation is invariably overdetermined. Change never occurs for one, two, or even three or four simple reasons. The changes in the role and power of women in the LDS Church are no exception. Let me present here three other examples, in addition to those that Claus has examined, of social changes during this period that have had it as an incidental effect the curtailment of women's autonomy and power. Several years ago, Marie Cornwall presented a paper in this forum arguing, as Claus has briefly discussed, that these changes in the role of women occurred as the institutional structure of the church became increasingly formalized under priesthood leadership. Marie makes the point that as the bureaucracy grew, so did the need for leadership, invariably defined by the formal institution as priesthood, and thus male leadership. An unintended consequence of this growth was that leaders, men, were always in short supply, available in quantities insufficient, particularly during the last 30 years, to support the rapid growth of the church membership. As a commodity in short supply, men became increasingly important and privileged within the system, and the church institutions began to focus more intensively on cultivating and attracting men. Female involvement became an issue of secondary importance, one that at times has perhaps even been irrelevant to the institution. One of the more obvious examples of this effect in our society and culture is when, and any of us have been missionaries, have heard this, where we are told as missionaries, seek the fathers. There's a major uncounting of the women and children. In effect, as a missionary, they're a liability to a growing branch or ward, not an asset. As a second example of concurrent social change, I argued in a paper I presented at the Washington, D.C. Symposium last March that another factor contributing to the transformation was the gradual transition, particularly in the Great Basin area, from a household-centered economy of agricultural and petty commodity production to a wage labor economy. To simplify the thesis, women in an agriculture and petty commodity producing economy are vital and essential participants in the economic life of the household. While these women are, in President Benson's terms, in the home, they are by no means not working. More importantly, their work is recognized for what it is, an important and critical contribution to the survival of the family. As Utah shifted and the Great Basin, the larger Great Basin area, shifted into a wage labor economy, primarily after World War II, work became something one was paid to do, something done outside of the home. In economic terms, household labor became invisible, uncounted, unvalued, unimportant, and increasingly peripheral to social reality. Within the church, women and the role of women became the focus of an intense structural conflict. On the one hand, an external society that increasingly defined people in terms of their work, leaving homemakers feeling comparatively worthless in economic terms, and on the other hand, an internal society fighting to keep women at home because of the very real and important role that someone needed to fill in raising and socializing children. Again, the changes in the larger in society have had an unintended and generally misunderstood impact on women in the church. Finally, Dave Knowlton's article on Mormon masculinity provides yet another causal factor that must be taken into consideration. To summarize a portion of his argument out of context, the concept of masculine within the church is socially constructed in conjunction with and in counterpoint to the concepts of masculinity held in the larger society. Because men within the church are expected to forego many of the outward symbols of masculinity used in the larger society, such as sexual activity, the church has created symbols of its own. One of the heaviest and most laden of these symbols is the priesthood, and hierarchical advancement. If we accept David's argument, the fact that power and authority within the church are a purely masculine domain is essential to the role that priesthood power and authority play in defining what it means to be male and Mormon. A challenge to the priesthood domain, or to the patriarchal nature of that hierarchy, becomes, therefore, an extremely psychologically laden challenge to the very identity of maleness in the church. An understanding of these issues, of how societies change, the broader issues, is for me vital to the ability to creatively exist in the many social domains that form my life. But there is another issue that has become increasingly important in my scholarship. There is no doubt in my mind but that 19th century Mormon women had more institutional space in which to move than we do today. I am not nearly as certain, however, that greater institutional space can be equated with greater freedom. Freedom is an ambiguous concept and must be contextualized. What we consider to be the greater autonomy of 19th century LDS women was bought at the price, I feel, of fewer alternative institutions and greater overall control by the patriarchal church. As women today, we have a different range of choices that govern how we define our individual relationships with the church. While there are no doubt constant attempts to constrict our awareness of the range of these choices, the embeddedness of the LDS Church within a larger society makes a total constriction impossible. As women, both within and without the church, we are becoming more independent spiritually, emotionally, intellectually, and economically. Within the larger society today, a woman's right of self-determination is more widespread across classes and cultures than at any time in recorded history. That is not to say, however, that this right is universal, or even that it is held by more than a tiny minority of women. It is my belief not only that women need to become more aware of the freedoms and powers that we have, but that we need to be more aware that these freedoms, for the few of us who have them, are bought at the cost of social upheaval and increasing insecurity for many people, including the vast majority of women. As Clause's paper indicates, it is far too simple, and thus ultimately useless, to argue that patriarchy is the only issue and its abolition the only solution. Social reality and social change are infinitely complex. In some sense, patriarchy is merely a competing form of hierarchy, perpetuated like all the other forms, because it concentrates power in the hands of a few who then fight to maintain their privileges. As we struggle to conceive and nurture a different world, we have to count the cost, if only because someone, somewhere, will have to pay it. As LDS women, we are paying a price. And within the church, as within the larger society, the cost of insecurity and social upheaval is imposed most heavily upon those least able to challenge the imposition, and who therefore tend to cling tightly to what security they think they have. As activist feminists, we have to understand that cost, how it arises, how it is counted, how it is allocated, and how it is paid. It is a cost that must be continually counted and recounted, analyzed and understood, as we attempt, both within the church and without, to minimize the social cost, to protect those least able to bear it, and to win in the process not only a greater right to self-determination as women and individuals, but an increased role in defining and developing the institutions of our society.
We have approximately 15 minutes remaining for your questions. Any of you who have questions, we would ask you to approach the microphone as we are on the air, and that way your questions will carry over the air. If there are no questions, we can close a little bit early. We thank you all for coming to this session.